Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, as well as on Delmarva Public Radio, as we bring to you Sound Bites, our weekly program on our food system. Sound Bites, 9 a.m. here on WSTL 90.7 FM on the Eastern Shore, and 6 p.m. on WSCL 89.5 FM, and repeat Sunday evenings on WSTL 90.7 FM and at 10 p.m. each on station on Sunday. And here, of course, on WEAA 88.9 FM here on the Mark Steiner Show every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m., as well as living on our website, steinershow.org, and on our Sound Bites website. So we are going to begin this conversation here this morning about the Farm Bill. We have with us in the studio Rebecca Klein, who is a Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project Director for the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. Always a mouthful, but good to have them on the air with us. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Errol Maddox is with us. He is a Small Farm Management Agent at the School of Agriculture and Natural Sciences at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Errol Maddox, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Good morning.
And Mark Hertzgard, Fellow of the New America Foundation, author most recently of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, and a noted writer and author and environmental activist, and always wonderful to have him on the air with us. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
It's early on the West Coast, but thank you for joining us.
That's okay. Happy to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Join us here at steinershow at gmail.com. Write to us at, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, or jump on our Facebook pages. We'll look there as well. So this Farm Bill, I remember, Mark Hertzgard, when you were on months back, a while back, talking about the Farm Bill because of the article that you wrote saying in some ways it might be better just to let the Farm Bill kind of fade away and die so we can fight for another year to make it right. What's your assessment of where we are right now?
Yeah, I wrote that back last September when right. There was still a chance that it could pass before the September 30 deadline. And I made that argument because I was saying that the bill was largely a pork barrel subsidy for the biggest farmers, and it was really perpetuating a lot of the problems that we've seen with U.S. agriculture policy, in particular, not preparing for climate change. Well, fast forward to now, was it 9 months later, and it kind of looks like deja vu all over again, except for the fact that on the House of Representatives side, they're trying to make it the bill even worse. The Senate has now passed a bill that is, in broad outline, pretty similar to the Farm Bill that the Senate passed last year. The House, as you know, is preparing to take up this bill this week, the House bill is being strongly criticized. In fact, the White House put out a veto threat just the other day,
right,
because the House bill wants to cut really quite dramatically into the food stamp budget. And, of course, food stamps is the single largest outlay in the Farm Bill. So it looks like there's another battle brewing. And unfortunately, the bottom line is it doesn't look like this Farm Bill is going to go anywhere in Washington this year.
Huh, you're conjecturing it may not pass at all?
Well, I think it may pass the House, but then they'll have to reconcile that with the Senate, and it's one more example, it appears to me, of the inability of lawmakers in Washington to really reach sensible compromises. Everyone is staking out their own quite extreme positions. In the case of the House Republicans, they want massive cuts in the food stamp part of the budget, but no cuts in the corporate welfare provisions that are being criticized by both the think tanks on both the left and the right. It's interesting. The think tanks and the activist groups on both the left and the right are criticizing these bills that are emerging from the House and the Senate for their corporate welfare, and yet in the House, what the Republicans seem most intent on doing is on stripping billions of dollars from the food stamp program.
And we're talking about, some people argue, and we'll go right here to Errol Maddox, that this food stamp program is a huge piece of the Farm Bill. And some people are suggesting is that the savings come from these tighter economic limits, outdated asset tests that could force more than 2 million people off of the ability to get food stamps to sustain families. And Errol Maddox, what's your take on where the Farm Bill is and what should happen?
I would agree with what has been said to a great extent. Compromise is a major issue. I think it will pass out of the, or it may not, from what I heard this morning, out of the House. And the major issue in the House has to do with milk subsidies.
Right.
And, And that creates, I've been following the milk issue fairly closely. The best comment I heard, someone said there are only four people in the U.S. Who understand the current milk policy issues. and they're all dead. So trying to get something out on the milk is going to be a major issue. And it probably will be voted out, but a reconciliation, I think, is not going to go anywhere. And we're going to start from square one. And the some of the provisions, particularly the specific provision on the SNAP issue, our food stamp issue, my opinion, and I'm only speaking for me, not the university, my opinion is that SNAP needs to be revised. There are some major issues that can be solved that would not have a major effect on the consumer. But reason and compromise are nowhere near in sight. The other concern I have is, since I work for the university, and is most of the research programs are held flat, no increased funding. I couldn't find anything there showing increased funding. So when you hold a program research flat, you really decrease funding because the cost of doing the business goes up. So I think it's going to wait probably until we see another Congress, but that this is going to do a CR on it and let it float along.
Rebecca, your take. I'm going to get some specifics here, but your take on all this. Rebecca Klein.
I also agree mostly with what's been said. It sounds very much like it may not pass the House, that they have barely enough votes to get it to pass, and they may change their mind and decide not to vote for the bill, some of the folks who have said that they will. I want it to pass. I think there are some innovative small programs in there that are starting to shift the food system in directions that we want to see it go.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I want the version that's on the Senate side to pass and not what's currently in the House and what could become worse with amendments on the House floor in the next couple of days. So we don't know yet how many amendments will be allowed or what kind of amendments will be allowed. That's being decided today. But once we find that out, it could be that the bill is degraded even more.
So tell me, what's the fundamental difference here between the two versions of the bill?
Well, what has already been said is the major difference is the about $4 billion in SNAP cuts on the Senate side versus about $20 billion on the House side. There are some small programs that exist right now for sure in the Senate bill around farmers market promotion programs, so money to help farmers markets expand, as well as food hubs and places to aggregate products that local and regional farmers are producing. There are some things on the House side right now, on the Senate side right now around conservation that are pretty good. Unfortunately, they cut conservation, and it could be that the House cuts conservation even more.
But what does conservation mean?
It's a range of programs. So as you know, the Farm Bill is quite complex, but there are some program. There are two programs that we call working lands conservation, and that means farmers who are working on the land producing food but also conserving soil, conserving water, protecting air quality in what they're doing. And there are two programs that help farmers who do that. One's called the Conservation Stewardship Program, and one's called the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. So if Hopkins titles are a mouthful, so is the Farm Bill. And then there's also something that we are really trying to fight for and keep in the bill called conservation compliance is sort of the short name for it, which is tying basic conservation measures. Farmers are going to do a small amount of conservation to do basic protection of their land in exchange for receiving government help, taxpayer help, to pay for their crop insurance premium subsidies.
So, and these are all, I understand the critical nature of these things, and I think people don't understand the complexity of agricultural economy in America, both in terms of whether it's a corporate-dominated aspect of agricultural economy, but what it means for the entire nation with this bill. And if this bill did not pass, let's say the threat of veto was there and that the bill could not come out of the Senate and the House and it didn't go anywhere, then it means that we revert back to the old bill?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And so that
if there's no continuing resolution, yes.
And that's part of the things you were talking about, Mark, the last time you were on, that's where it should end up, and that you think in some ways that would give people time to organize and fight around this issue and build something better.
Well, you would think it would give them time to organize. You also would think that it would put a bit of urgency into the lawmakers in Washington. But unfortunately, we've now run this experiment. You know, this is what happened last September. They did not pass a bill. They ended up sort of extending things through the whole sequester deal at the end of the year. And unfortunately, there were some as we went back to sort of the status quo situation, we lost out of the Farm Bill a lot of really valuable programs. They're not the big money programs, but they're the things that are helping small farmers. They're the things that are helping first-time farmers, young people who are trying to get into farming. There's a lot of programs that are trying to encourage that. And the conservation initiatives, all of those were left to the side. So I think it's really, I just want to salute you, Mark, for putting the focus on the Farm Bill, because as you said, I think a lot of people don't quite understand just how important the Farm Bill is to your daily life as an American. Michael Pollan, the author, has argued that we shouldn't be calling this the Farm Bill. We should be calling it the Food Bill. Because the decisions that are made in this bill about what the U.S. government, i.e. you, the taxpayer, are encouraging farmers to plant and not to plant, and how to plant, this is what determines what ends up on our dinner plates. And so it also determines, as someone says, this is not just a food bill, it's a jobs bill, it's an energy bill. These are the critical decisions that are shaping so much of the U.S. economy, and it's unfortunate that it is called the Farm Bill, because I think for a lot of urban and suburban right. people, they kind of think, oh, that's for those hicks who live out in the country. Well, as someone who grew up on a farm, one of those hicks out in the country, I want to tell you, just remember, no farms, no food.
Amen to that. And Mark, I understand you had a hard time hearing Errol. We're trying to get that fixed in our phone system. Errol, were you able to hear Mark in this conversation?
Oh, yes, okay. I could hear him. So, if I may... chime in on one issue.
Errol Maddox, go ahead.
We talked a bit about the impact of the food stamp / SNAP program. There is a provision that was voted out of the House, it caused me to chuckle, is that it would prohibit USDA from advertising the fact that the program exists.
So even more poor people will not be able to get subsidies to buy food in the grocery store.
Absolutely. And on the point of the impact, with what Rebecca referenced, it having to do with conservation issues, stormwater management issues, we live near the bay, the clean up the bay impact, all of these things tie in together, and it does have an impact on urban dwellers from everything from the choice of foods they receive, from where the food comes from, the country labeling argument is involved in there, the issue of ownership of meat. The House version basically said that major meat packers can own the meat or the animals, and there would be no transparency on how it's priced.
Wow.
So it's very, very, very complex, and regrettably, I'm a pessimist on getting a better bill. The House has no need from their constituency to pass out a better bill.
Right.
That's a critical point.
Yeah, I think that's the sad truth, and not the sad truth, but it's reality. The House members are doing the will of what they perceive as the majority of their constituency, and until someone decides to change and become bold, we are going to have an impasse on this for a long time.
Rebecca, Mark, both of us have been saying, why don't you start very quickly, Rebecca, and then we'll go to Mark to respond to what you heard Errol say and why you were agreeing so vehemently.
I absolutely agree that there's just no incentive for folks to pass this. There's also, right now, I believe, and the other guests can correct me if I'm wrong, that both the food stamp program and some of the insurance and subsidy programs are permanently authorized through separate legislation, and so right now there's no incentive from those major constituencies to make changes because the status quo is going to continue for them. The amount of food stamps wasn't impacted too much by the sequestration and other budget changes that we've had, and so those large groups who have been the major voices on Capitol Hill around these issues don't have as much incentive to make a change, and certainly it's better if we just keep, for them, if we keep doing a continuing resolution as versus making some tweaks to the bill that in the long run, we see making improvements.
Mark, you were about to say what?
That's one of the points. And the second point, so the first point is that, yeah, the status quo, the big players, they can live with it. But the second point is that, you know, because of the way of gerrymandering and the way that our electoral districts in the country, throughout the country, have been reconfigured in recent years through Republican control of, you know, the individual state houses in 50 states, you now have a situation where most of the Republican representatives in the House of Representatives in particular, they don't really have to face a broad-spectrum electorate. Their electorate already skews very far to the right, and so there's no incentive for them to compromise, to reach voters in the middle, because they know that they can still be elected holding to their extreme positions. And if you talk to the political campaign strategists in Washington, they'll tell you that most of the Republicans, what they fear is not the general election in November. They fear a challenge in the primary election, and they fear that challenge from their right if they're a Republican. So if you're a Republican and you fear that the Tea Party is going to run somebody against you, and the Tea Party is demanding that we slash the food stamp program because supposedly there's all of these moochers out there who are just living it up on the food stamp program, well, why would you do anything other than follow the Tea Party position? That's the critical aspect. And frankly, we see this as well in the other thing we mentioned earlier in the program, climate change. If you're a Republican in Congress, it doesn't matter that probably privately you know perfectly well that the science on climate change is solid. As a political matter, you're looking at getting reelected, and what's going to prevent you from getting reelected is a challenge from the far right. And so that is why, not just on this farm bill, food bill aspect, but on so much of the business before the U.S. Congress, we don't seem to be able to get to any kind of just common sense sort of compromise, because there's no political incentive for the most of the Republican Party to compromise.
And I just wanted to, you mentioned earlier, Errol, I want to get to this, and before we come back, go back to Rebecca, is that you mentioned that how nobody understands the dairy part of this bill. And I think it's important, though, because one of the things that people don't see is there's a battle between the national milk producers, the people who actually raise our cows, whether they be organic or in the industrial model, whatever, but raise the cows, and those and the industry that represents the companies that own the milk, cheese, and ice cream that we consume, and how all this affects our pocketbooks when we go to the grocery stores. This is a complex yet very important part of this bill.
Absolutely. And within the dairy industry, there are at least three factions arguing on how milk should be priced. Another issue is there are the dairy co-ops that are supposedly representing the dairymen, but many of them have close relationships with the people who change the form of milk from, you know, fluid milk into cheese, yogurt, et cetera, et cetera. The one issue with dairy that no one I've read chooses to address is the fact that Americans do not consume dairy products at the rate they did 30 years ago. But the cows are producing more milk with fewer cows. So we have a fundamental concern, fundamental problem. And how do we
right.
solve it? We don't want kids to drink whole milk. We don't eat too much ice cream. We don't want whole fat cheese. We want to export, and one of the craziest ones I saw is trying to develop an export market to China. Chinese folks, Asians, do not consume dairy except at a very tiny rate. But we want tax dollars to somehow create this market. But it's a very, 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 very complex issue, and folks are just not sitting down to the table to say, look, we have a problem, how can we solve it? And what comes out is do it my way, and it's not going to happen.
Errol, you hit the madness of it, I think, on point with dairy, and that people don't realize what it also means for the prices we pay. If we really pay the real price, We've been paying like $5, $6, $7, $8, $9, $10 for a gallon of milk.
Absolutely.
You know, people don't get that at all. I think in this bill, that's important enough for us to understand. And I think the other part is, and let me just start with Rebecca and then go to Mark and we'll close out with Eric. We have like 5 minutes left in this segment. How do you can you, for want of a better term, I'm making up a word, I think, decorporatize the bill to make it more about farming and food as opposed to what, given that almost every farmer in America, 90% of farmers in America, are tied to corporations in terms of the land and what they have to do. How do you even begin to change all of that? Rebecca, very quickly, and then go to Mark.
That's a great question. And other than a magic wand, I think it's campaign finance reform is really what we need. And that's going to take a long time if we even ever get that. And so right now, all we can do is get more people to understand how this bill impacts them, why it's important. And it's great that you're having the show about it, because people in Congress, members of Congress, will listen to their constituents because they want to win the election. But right now, it's the money that helps them win, and it's the money that's talking. And so what we need is the people to start talking. We need to turn ourselves from consumers of these food products back into citizens of this country.
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's right. But let me just take it a step further and say that there are a lot of groups out there who are working on this. And what would help is for citizens to get involved with those groups and to realize that there has been a strong effort on this. It's led by groups like the National Farmers Union, which wants a bill to pass, the Environmental Working Group, the National Taxpayers for Common Sense. As I said earlier, these groups stretch across the political spectrum from left to right. So whatever your own particular view is, you can get involved. But there is no substitute for people getting involved. And you're raising the right question, Mark. It's the corporatized system here and the corporatized control of so much of government that has to be gone after. And, you know, I think that there's an appetite for that in the country. It's gone up and down. We saw the Occupy movement arise a while back. And while that did not lead to any kind of specific changes yet, I think that mood is growing in the country. And as long as the lawmakers on Capitol Hill ignore it, they will do that at their peril. It will look fine to them for a while as they continue to get the corporate funding to run their campaigns. But eventually, if that anger is organized and begins to boil over, I think that we could finally see some real change on this.
Nero Maddox, a final thought from you, a man with his hands in the land. What do you think?
I agree to it to a great extent, but I, being a pessimist on many days, part of the reality of this society we live in, back to the corporate issue, is distribution of foodstuffs. The only way our system works, of you being able to walk into your local grocery store, your local Super Fresh today, and buy asparagus or kiwi fruit, is through the corporate system. And Americans are well wedded to the fact that they can buy any food they want at any time if they have the money. But there are changes occurring on a local level. Part of what I do, what I get paid to do, is to work with folks to produce food and sell it with close by. That takes it out of the corporate system. But most urban dwellers in particular have no choice. If you're living in Southwest D.C., there is not much food grown within 20 miles of you. So we have a circle that has to be broken, and the corporate ties create the system we have. They have created the system we have because, I mean, as an example, yogurt, most of it's made in upstate New York, but it's distributed across the country. Without the corporate system, we can't have that, but we as consumers want it. And it's a two-sided concern. I don't know, except waving the magic wand, how we make it better, but we can move much of the production out of the corporate distribution system, but the consumer, back to what's been said before, the consumer has to demand it, and retailers will respond to demand. But as long as we are complacent as consumers, we're not going to get much change.
Errol Maddox is a small farm management agent in the School of Agricultural and Natural Sciences at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And Mark Hertzgard is a fellow of the New America Foundation, author most recently of his most recent book being Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, and has written numerous articles recently on this and many other issues that we'll be linking to on our website. And Rebecca Klein is Public Health and Agricultural Policy Project Director for the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, one of the partners we work with all the time on these programs. And Rebecca Klein, Errol Maddox, Mark Hertzgard, thank you all so much for taking time this morning with our listeners here on Soundbites.
Hey, thank you very much.
We're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to take another trip back to Baltimore, this time to look at a group of urban farmers who's fighting to keep farming on the land that people want to put buildings on top of as they work to feed people who don't have food. Stay with us. Mark Steiner, welcome back to Soundbites and to the Mark Steiner Show here, both here in WEAA and our sister stations on Marvel Public Radio, as we look at issues facing the future of our food system. And some of that future, people say, is in our urban settings, where many people are farming in urban areas. People don't think that we can feed the entire world by farming in urban areas, but we can shortchange a part of what we do. We visited the Free Farm before and did a small documentary on their work. Some months back, and their members have been on the show in different panel discussions. And it turns out that the land that they've been farming in a neighborhood called Hamden in Baltimore is now under threat of development, and they've been using this farm to feed folks in their communities, which is a working-class community. And we're here joined by two people involved with the Free Farm right now. Billy Thomas is on the organizing committee member of the End Farmer for the Baltimore Tree Farm. And Billy, good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
And John Smeaton, did I say that right?
Perfect.
I'm not sure I wasn't I had it right. John Smeaton is a Johns Hopkins community impact intern at the Baltimore Free Farm. Good to have you here, John, as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Billy, what is the deal? I mean, you've been farming these plots that were empty for a long time, right?
Right.
So give us a bit of the history on what's happening and to lead us up to this moment.
Well, back in 2010, we came across these lots and decided that we wanted to build a garden there that we would use in conjunction with the community to create a fresh food source right in the middle of Hamden.
You're talking about a working-class community in the heart of Baltimore.
Correct.
Right.
And so this year we have come into a little bit of an issue with some of the land that we're farming on. About a third of our space in the last year has been put up for sale. A sixth of it has been sold, and we are currently trying to bid on with the city to claim the sixth of the land that is available to purchase right now.
So what does this mean? I mean, what do you think you're up against, John?
Well, ultimately, we're bidding in a process that's normally formalized for housing. But what it puts us up against is trying to get enough support from our community to really show that what we've put together is of value. And we've been overwhelmed with that.
What do you mean you've been overwhelmed with that?
Well, just within the past 2 weeks, we've managed to get 1,000 petition signatures from the local community. We've been actually asked if people could donate money to help us bid for this land. And we've had more donations than money we could even raise ourselves. And we've also gotten a letter of support from Councilman Mosby. It's really been surprising. And just to hear the stories that people tell about how the farms made a difference for people is inspiring enough.
Like, give us an example. How is this? Because you look at this, is this comes kind of countercultural farm. Who cares if they want to grow food? Let them grow their own food somewhere else. But what you're saying, John, then Billy, is something. This is not just about a collective of young people farming. This is about people farming with the community and doing something more than that. This is a critical piece of this, I think.
Yeah, we think that this is a really good opportunity for the city to help toe the line on the green movement in Baltimore, and to evaluate the use of space and the type of development that is important. Like, currently, we are developing the space with a vision that we have for it. This isn't a issue of whether to develop or not to develop, because we are developing it. It's about the type of development that we want to see in our neighborhoods.
And that's the issue here. I mean, the issue here is whether these land will be developed for houses, and I'm sure the city part of the mindset of city housing is, well, we want to take this land and build houses so we can bring these upper middle class people to Baltimore to pay taxes in Baltimore, and that could be a priority in their heads over farming for poor working people.
I mean, I hesitate to speculate on what their exact motivations
are. I'll do that.
But thank
you. I'll do that.
Yeah, but I mean, from our perspective, yeah, it makes sense for the city to accept our bid on the Baldwin lots because of our track record in caring for the space, because of the environmental and educational and cultural opportunities that we provide for the community as a whole, and we have examples of all of those that we can share with you,
mm-hmm,
and also because our bid is financially competitive with the developers, and that this isn't just some low bid, low balling, you know, wish stream here. Like, this is something that the city, in our perspective, I think, should strongly consider. And we believe that they will decide to accept our bid at this point based on the amount of support that we've generated in such a short amount of time.
John, how do you see it?
The way I look at it is the city has definitely spoken a lot about its commitments to urban agriculture, to its commitments of providing fresh food for people, to its commitments of reducing urban blight or stormwater runoff or just trash in general. And all of these things are really ideological symbols of what the farm does. So it only makes sense, and it's in their best interest to retain the farm in its proper form so that it can be continued to be developed for the community's benefit.
So the land in question, I'm curious about what you're growing on this land and how it's distributed and just what you're doing with it. I mean, I think it sounds great, but how does this actually
work? Can I talk to you about our free food days that we have? Okay,
absolutely.
So every Wednesday at the free farm, for almost the last year, it seems like, we have been distributing food that we reclaim from grocers and food distributors to save from the waste stream. And that's usually ripe produce and fruits of all sorts, including groceries. Besides that, we also will contribute a large amount of the overproduction that we experience each year in the space, because we do farm with all volunteers. So a lot of volunteers come in from groups, and we're able to grow far more than we ourselves are able to consume. And in an effort not to commodify what we produce, we will distribute that with the food that we reclaim every Wednesday at the free farm from noon until 5. We'll give away several hundred pounds of food each week. Since April, we've given away over a ton of food. We've recorded
about
2,500 pounds of food. I'm not sure if that's actually it.
Whatever that is, yeah. It's a lot of food.
So, you know, each week now we have been, you know, recording how much food we're giving away to get a picture of it, because all we're seeing is pickup trucks load of food coming in and that we go out and gather, which is a task in itself, as well as harvesting it from the spaces that we grow in, such on Baldwin Street, the lots that we're bidding on right now. What this really does mean is that there will be less of that available to give out to the community with these spaces going out. I mean, we see that the free farm provides like a better long-term investment for the city, because the lots are so small. Like, to build houses on these lots seems almost like a not as good use of the space. The distribution of the food is normally public.
So how many people are taking advantage of this food that you're distributing? Do you know?
It's between 100, I mean, 50 and 100 each week, it seems like, that will take food back to their families. We record. We have people sign in, and so we can see where the food's going and, like, to what zip code, basically, in the city. And it's all staying in Baltimore, and a lot of it's staying in Hamden.
You were about to say something, John? I'm sorry. Did that cut you off?
Yeah, no. Since we've been keeping numbers, it seems that we've distributed to around 200 different people.
You're feeling fairly optimistic about this, about your ability to keep this land in the face of developers who are already buying parcels of it?
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Why do you feel so optimistic about it?
Because that we think that the city will see this as an opportunity to create a development that is long-term and lasting for their community, and the community, it seems like this is what the community wants, and we believe that the city will represent us.
Mm-hmm. Go
ahead, John, please.
In addition, our bid is definitely financially competitive, and our track record in the past have shown that we've been able to develop this land fairly successfully, whereas attempts in the past haven't unfortunately worked out for the developers to develop the land that's adjacent to it.
So, I mean, how would you put the money together to do this? I mean, you're not exactly the wealthiest crew in town, so how do you?
Well, really wasn't even our idea. We felt like that we were going to be self-funding the minimum bid amount, and that was our original plan, is to put the bid in as our own small form of protest. But when we saw the support that began to come in, both through letters of support that direct neighbors around the garden were willing to write, and as well as in our petitioning actions, the level of support that we felt that while we were petitioning, like, people were thanking us a lot for the work that we'd done, people that we didn't even realize that we touched, you know, had been paying close attention to us, and the changes that have happened in the neighborhood. And then we had a few different people in the community raised the idea that they could write letters of commitment to us to be for us to be more competitive in our bid process.
Yeah, so when we first heard this story, there was kind of a real worry that that you did not have a leg up, because many times people in these communities, in our communities, don't win a lot of these battles. Developers can often win these mm-hmm. battles, but this is how there's been a turn in the road since we first heard about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, that the city sees that we're professionals and that we are working within the law, and they should consider us as being developers just like any other developer. It's just a matter of to build houses or to not build houses, mm-hmm. you know. And in a city where there are plenty of vacant houses, like, we see a moral obligation to resist construction of new houses. You know, we should be fixing our city. And the areas that are being taken care of by the citizens here that have invested their time and money into the spaces, the vacant land, should be left to the people who are taking care of them. Because move on to a different problem. This one's taken care of.
It's how do people get to know about this more? They want to be involved. They want to kind of push the effort to keep land free. How do they free for farming in mm-hmm. the city? How do they do that?
Definitely. So the easy thing to do to keep, you know, be aware of it is to just check our Facebook regularly, because we're going to have updates about what happens as the battle continues. Otherwise, we have a petition that we've put out. It's a general land allocation petition, and it can be applied to any instance. So if this were to ever arise again, signing it now would still influence what we're able to do in the future. And finally, if you're really interested in helping out, just email us at collective@baltimorefreefarm.org. You can find our contact information also on our website.
And what's the webpage? I mean, what is the Facebook page we're talking about?
Baltimore Free Farm.
Baltimore Free Farm, just make sure.
And it's baltimorefreefarm.org is our main website.
And we'll have all that on our website, so people can connect with that here on Soundbites. Billy Thomas is organizing committee member and farmer of Baltimore Free Farm, John Smeaton. John Smeaton is a Johns Hopkins community impact intern at the Baltimore Free Farm. Billy and John, good to have you both with us, and we'll hopefully keep this thing alive and our listeners' ears and eyes, and let's hope this is successful.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much. It's been great to have you.
Great.
We're going to now hear Soundbites producer Mark Ennery brings us a report from Baltimore's newest farmers market, Union Grays, in our continuing series of farmers markets here in the Baltimore area and throughout the Eastern Shore of Maryland and Delmarva. Stay with us.
It's a warm Friday evening in the Hampton neighborhood of Baltimore. The air is filled with the old-timey music of Stringtown and smoke from a massive grill, where a dozen people are lined up, waiting for hot dogs and hamburgers. Vendors are selling everything from pork to sauerkraut, and the beer, cider, and kombucha are flowing. This is a debut event of Baltimore's newest farmers market called Union Grays. I caught up with local farmer and frequent Soundbites contributor Denzel Mitchell at his farm stand. He is the founder of Five Seeds Farm and Apiary in Sparks in Baltimore, Maryland. I asked him what Union Grays was all about.
Union Grays is a weekly market event of local farms and artisanal product makers. These are all folks that are sustainable product makers, farmers, and we all decided to come together and do a nighttime market here in Hamden in Baltimore. So we partnered with Woodbury to do a really concentrated weekly event to bring folks out so they could enjoy some good food, some drink. Union Craft Brewery is here from the neighborhood, and also Millstone Cellar, which is up in Moncton, and they do meads and hard ciders. So everybody decided to come together and do a weekly event, and it's really nice.
And why do you think it's important to have events like this?
It is important to have events like this because, you know, this is how we change the food system. It's very important that we come together and put a different face on the products that are available to people here within their city, within their community. And because we don't have access to television and the radio, you know, we got to do events like this and create direct relationships with the customers and the producers or the growers, which builds the food system. So, you know, it's been fantastic. You know, we're really building community. There's a lot of folks that are a member of all three CSAs that are here. So that's awesome. That's what it's all about. So, you know, so folks are able to come and pick up their chicken, come and pick up their pork, and come and pick up their vegetables all in the same place, the same time. And, you know, those are the kind of connections we need to make, and that's how we really affect what's happening in the food system.
What do you think needs changing in the food system?
So, obviously, the first thing is that the exchange between customer and producer needs to be direct. There's producers all over the state, all over the country, who are trying to market directly to their customers. And, you know, none of us should have to go through a middleman to sell our products. You know, we spend a lot of time out in the fields, or we spend a lot of time in the shops producing our products, producing, you know, our kombucha, or spinning honey, or making cheese. And it's much better for us to make that direct relationship with the customers, somebody that we could tell our story to, so that the word of mouth will spread and you gain more customers that way. That's one. The other thing is that a lot of the folks here are using sustainable methods. They're closing the loop. They're reducing waste. Their carbon footprint is low because they're coming right out of Baltimore, or if not right out of Baltimore, just outside of Baltimore. And so the amount of petroleum that's being used to get these products to the customers is a lot less, which is huge. The other thing is, you know, this is an opportunity for everybody to learn. Everybody's not eating this way. You know, a lot of times we take it for granted as farmers that everybody wants to eat like this and everybody doesn't. You know, but this is a great opportunity for people to come here and learn that, yes, there is pork being produced within 100 miles of where I live, and I can purchase it. It's a good opportunity for people to find out that, yes, the sauerkraut can and is being produced in Baltimore, and I can buy it directly from somebody that produces it in the traditional way, using local ingredients that haven't been sprayed with chemicals, and I can support a family. All that stuff is really important.
Five Seeds Farm is named after Denzel and his wife's five children, and as we spoke, one of them was busy helping a couple fill their CSA share.
Hi. These are scallions.
Okay, thank you.
Here is endive.
Awesome.
Thanks. Here's some mustard greens. My name is Monsadine. I'm a CSA manager.
Can you explain what a CSA is?
A CSA is when you pay $500 online and then you come to Union Grays or the Tool Library every Thursday and Friday, and I give them their produce. I was here. I was just, and now I'm in there giving them. Now they're giving me their stuff, and then they give me the money, and then yeah.
Now, how old is your CSA manager?
My CSA manager, this week's CSA manager, is 8 years old. Yeah, and he's doing a great job. And he's getting paid, so I'm not exploiting his time or efforts at all.
And will you just tell me a little bit about your apprentice system?
We met with some young people earlier this spring that were really interested in learning how to farm, and I felt like I you know, I had some information that I could share. And so we decided to take on two apprentices that eventually want a farm. And so they're spending time with us at the farm once a week. They're actually kind of taking the lead on the city farm, the farm that's in the city, to manage that. And it's been fantastic. So they're two locals that graduated from Morgan. They're creating their own crop plan. They're going to do some marketing. They're going to come to market with us. So it's been good.
I met one of Denzel's apprentices, Aaliyah Frazier, when she picked up some produce from the stand.
What kind of work do you do at the farm?
So right now, everything's a learning process since I'm very new to this. So every time I go out there, they're teaching me how to harvest, how deep plants need to be planted, teaching me the science of agriculture. They call it agroecology, and since we all like have natural hair, afroecology is a pretty cool term.
And what's your background?
I'm from Baltimore, so that's why I'm invested in bringing forth health and urban farming into Baltimore. But for 2 years, I was a teacher in Camden teaching science. Now I'm working at Hopkins doing research and applying to PhD programs. So ultimately, I would like to merge research and PhD program with farming by researching like the benefits of herbs and food on our health and diet, mental health, all that.
What do you think about Union Grace?
Oh, I really like it. This is my first time here. I think it's a really good community vibe. Everyone's out here enjoying themselves, getting fresh produce, and mainly connecting and talking to other people that we never knew before. So I really like it.
Hey, Monsadine, what kind of vegetables do you have today?
Scallions, endive, salad mix, garlic scapes, parsley, thyme, zucchini, mushrooms, green snap peas, head lettuce, and squash blossoms.
And what's your favorite?
My favorite is the garlic scapes.
What's a garlic scape?
A garlic scape is this. It's like a scallion, but it's like cut off, and it tastes spicy.
It's crazy looking.
Yeah. Here, taste one. They're sort of hot after you taste a little bit of it.
It's good.
Yeah.
And do you live at Five Seeds Farm?
Yeah, I live at Five Seeds Farm in Sparks, Maryland.
How do you like being a farmer?
It's great. Especially when I get to hear the chickens every day.
That was Monsadine Mitchell of Five Seeds Farm and Apiary. You also heard Denzel Mitchell and Aaliyah Frazier. You can visit Union Grays every Friday from now until November 22nd. It runs from 4:30 to 8 p.m. and is at 1500 Union Avenue in Baltimore in the Union Mill Courtyard. For Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show, I'm Mark Gunnery.
And we conclude our soundbite today with a recipe for a simple and refreshing take-home pasta, spaghetti aglio e olio, from UMBC senior and culinary aficionado Sam Levin.
L'amore cammina, stipi lo tondo, sciuri, 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 tutto l'anno.
My name is Sam Levin. I'm a senior at UMBC studying information systems. For high school, I attended a Carver Center for the Arts and Technology in Towson, and there my prime or specialty was culinary. I got to work with a lot of cool chefs in Baltimore, so that sort of like inspired me to keep going with this as mostly just a hobby. So what we're going to try to prepare here today is spaghetti aglio e olio. It's a big change of pace from just pasta and red sauce. Basically, it's really, really simple, and that's the point. The only ingredients that you really need are spaghetti, olive oil. Olive oil should be something of an investment since that's sort of a main component. Cheaper olive oils have a bitter taste to them, usually. A nicer olive oil tastes maybe more fruity and smooth. It doesn't have any sort of harsh aftertaste either. And then you're going to need like crushed red pepper flakes, Italian parsley, not curly parsley, and a bulb of garlic.
So you already started some of the prep. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you did here already?
You have to make sure to like, you know, pick the parsley from the stems and give it a wash. And then you got to unwrap each piece of garlic.
So you have a handful of parsley picked from the stem, 3 cloves of garlic peeled.
Yeah, it also depends on like how big the cloves of garlic too. I never break my spaghetti. So I usually cook with a taller pot and I fill it up maybe halfway or almost all the way. But you know, just enough water that like you push the pasta down as it when it gets up to a boil. You should add enough salt to make the water taste pretty salty.
For this recipe that you're gonna make right now, how much of the box are you gonna put in?
I'm gonna throw in like a half a box. After you get the water boiling, you should prepare your garlic by cutting them into pretty thin little hockey pucks. You want to cut the garlic lengthwise from the pointed end down to the base and to relatively thin slices that way. Just slice it up like that. Depending on how much you're making, it's really up to you. I really like garlic, so I'm probably going to throw in maybe like a whole tablespoon. While you're bringing your water to boil, you're going to fill up your sauté pan with a decent amount of olive oil, enough to cover or coat your spaghetti. You're going to keep it cold. You don't want to turn on the heat yet. And in that same time, you're going to also add in the garlic. Because you don't want to burn the garlic. The point is not to burn the garlic, but to like lightly cook and toast it. You're going to cook the garlic and the oil until it becomes just browned. You can even taste it if you want to make sure that harsh raw flavor is gone. And the olive oil should get some of the flavor of the garlic, and the garlic should get some of the flavors of the olive oil, and it should really mellow itself out. You just want to keep an eye on it. It's going to start sizzly bubbling, like very slight bubbles. You don't want it to start frying the garlic. So while you have your garlic and the olive oil on a low heat, and you're trying to get your water up to a boil, you should prepare your parsley. With that, we're just going to mince it up. Pretty normally, it's just gonna go onto the pasta. The Italian parsley is a good contrast to the really nutty, mellow flavors that you're gonna produce with the olive oil and garlic. So after about like 4 minutes, the garlic on a pretty low heat should be sizzling very slightly. It should be a nice golden brown. Once you feel like the garlic is about to just be golden brown, like it's just about to be ready, you can add in enough crushed peppered flakes to make it as spicy as you want. After you throw in the crushed pepper flakes, just give it a little stir. Keep an eye on it. Once you have the water at a boil, you're going to throw in your spaghetti. Some people time their pasta. I'm more by taste.
So you turned off the heat when you noticed that a lot of them were getting brown.
Yeah, when they start to get golden, you should turn off the heat. And you want to throw in anywhere from, depending on how much oil you have, a couple tablespoons to half a cup of the starchy, salty water.
And why are you doing that?
Throwing in the spaghetti water, it stops the garlic from overcooking. After you strain the pasta, you're going to dump it in with the sauté pan where the oil was cooking. You want to toss your spaghetti in the garlicky oil sauce. You want to get the garlic all mixed in there. And you can eat these pieces of garlic. They shouldn't taste bad. I mean, as long as they're just slightly gold. After you toss the spaghetti in the oil, then you can go ahead and add in your chopped up parsley. You want to portion it off into a decent bowl and serve it up to your special someone. Yeah, thank you so much for joining me.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.